From KMUW Wichita.
From Toronto, Ontario.
And from Armenia, Spain.
This is You're Saying It Wrong. Let's talk words. Let's talk translation. Sometimes when we take things from other languages, we kind of have to force them to make sense. Sometimes it works, too. I'm Fletcher Powell, host and producer at KMUW in Wichita, Kansas. And joining me, as they do each week, language experts and New York Times bestselling authors Kathy Petras and Ross Petras. Hi, Kathy. Hi, Ross. We'll just get going because we've got to touch on a lot of stuff today. Wait, we have to touch on a lot of stuff today. Wait, which is it? Do I gotta or do I have to?
You gotta. Have to.
You gotta.
Yeah, this is a...
A toughie. This is a conundrum. This was a pet peeve email we got from Jason in Jersey City. I love it when they're like... Actually, it would been better... Never mind. If you had two J's. Okay, well, anyway, Jason wrote, is I have to, fill in the blank, dead? I've been noticing that everyone, me included, never says, I have to go or I have to do that. It's, I've got to go. I've got to do that. What's going on? I've got to know.
Okay, before you say anything else, did he say I apostrophe V-E?
Yes, he did.
Okay, yeah. So that have is still in there the way he said it.
Well said, Fletcher.
Oh, you're right.
Well said.
Good point.
Now, we hear people say, like, I gotta go, and I might even say that.
That's interesting. Right now, just right now, let's do an unscientific survey. Would you say, I've gotta go, or I gotta go?
I gotta go.
I'm presuming we all say gotta, because we're all Americans right here. We're just gonna give a little clue, but
yeah.
What do you say, Kathy? Gotta go? I say gotta go.
I've gotta go.
Fletcher?
Well... If we're talking about going, I would probably say, I gotta go. But
that's what I would say.
But if we're talking about something else, like I've got to finish my homework, whatever, I don't have any homework.
Wow.
That's different. I would probably say I've.
You're right. I would do the same thing. I gotta go, guys. I'm leaving right now. I've gotta do a lot of work today. You're right.
Yeah.
Brilliant, Fletcher.
I gotta go. I've got to. Yeah.
Yeah, I gotta go.
I gotta go.
Do you ever say I have to, though? Because do you say, like, I gotta go, I have to do a lot of work?
No, I would say I've got a lot of work.
I would always throw the God in there again.
Yeah.
I wonder. I'm gonna have to listen to myself. I wonder if I say I have to do anything anymore. I haven't thought about that, like, with my own speech.
Okay. I think there are times we say I have to do that. I think that, but it's more like an imperative. Like
that's
like,
a, no, like, it's not like, an imperative. It's actually really emphasizing that you have to do
it. Yeah. I have to do that. I have to. But if it's talking about something I will be doing, I was going to say, I've got to do that.
Yeah.
I didn't say I have to do that. Yeah.
Exactly. Which is interesting. Basically, the key thing is that have to and got both, basically, as we all agree, they mean the same thing. Yes, I have got. And it's a little bit redundant. But it's used, and the have got tends to be more used colloquially, and the have to tends to be more in writing, etc. Didn't you do a thing online? Didn't you just try to
I
look
did.
And see?
I just, I, it was really unscientific. I just put I have to versus I've got to on Google search. I mean, I didn't even do it in Ingram. And I got over 2 billion I have to's and only 107 million I've got to. But I think that's because what you're saying, Rose, it's one is I think the informal you're talking, and one is writing. When I write, I don't think I do I've got to.
Right.
Particularly. I might like on social media or something or in an email, but even there I might not.
Yeah. I have to. I automatically revert to the I have to there. Exactly.
Yeah.
I do the same thing. Kathy wrote a couple of rules up for the usage just for the fun of it. In general with both have and have got, they both become before the main verb. You have to try these cakes. You have got to try these cakes.
Mm-hmm.
They're usually they're contracted. You've got to try these cakes, etc.
Yeah, you don't say you have got. Yeah.
No. And they cannot be followed by a modal verb. Remember we talked about modal verbs a while back?
Yeah. Modal verbs. Remind me.
There are helper verbs that basically have an imperative implied. You have to do this or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, and they don't have the to. We said we've got to take. The to take is a regular verb, but you can't say we've
must take.
Yeah, I mean that's more. Must. The to take is a regular verb with the to in front. Yeah, we've to must take. You can't say obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And
then you have got. You use when the verb is you can use it alone, but if you get it, does he have to do that? Yes, he has to. Yes, he's got to. You can do it that way too.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I just wanted to say the difference between British and American English, when it's possession, not like I've got to do that, but when it's I have got, it's really common more in British English to say I have got a cat, I have got an exam today. Whereas in American English, you say I have a cat, I have an exam.
Mm-hmm.
But in English too, like we would say gotten in a different, in American English though, I'm not sure it's British the same way. I've got a new hat would mean I have a new hat. I've gotten a new hat means like I've just obtained
I've just acquired it. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's like a huge difference when you think about it. Instantly when you say I've got a new hat, I go, yeah, oh, great, you got a new hat. I've gotten a new hat to me means you just got a new hat. It's weird.
Uh-huh.
Gotten versus got in that case you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So even though we don't use gotten that much in American English, I really instantly know that's the problem with learning a new language, though. That's like a really subtle difference that we all instantly knew.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
And you're not going to find that in some grammar book, I imagine, that easily with you have like you're looking up verbs in English.
Well, what do you look up? Yeah, that's the whole problem, too. It's like, how do you start?
I know.
And this was, I'm sorry, we have one more question that's related to this about have. It was Debbie from Florida who said, I'm listening to Prince Harry's book. And he caused me to have a language question. That Harry. He said at one point he talks about going into hotel and saying, have you a room? We Yanks would say, do you have a room?
Right.
Mm-hmm. When, how, why did that phrasing between British and American English evolve? Have you a room? Yeah, I would never say, have you this?
Have you a room sounds really snooty. It sounds like, hello, you know?
Well, he's a prince. Come on.
Yeah.
We talked a few weeks ago about that inversion.
Yeah, that's what we said in our reply to Debbie.
Oh, okay. Tell me
more. We said, we're talking here something we talked about a couple of times. We're talking about do support. Mm-hmm. Have you a room is the older, more traditional form, more common in British. Do you have a room is obviously do support. We're adding the do. It became more normal in the American English beginning in the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
And it's starting to gain ground in Britain now, too. The have you is dying out in favor of the more American do you have.
I wondered. Yeah, I guess obviously not at the very top of the class structure. If Prince Harry's walking in saying, have you a room?
Have you a room, yeah.
Know your audience, Harry. Come on.
It is interesting, though. Like, I mean, what really always gets me about language is how we throw in things, new constructions. Have you a room is fine. When you think about it, it works perfectly well. Why do we do support? Why do we change to do you have? Like, it's more words.
Yeah.
But it sounds far more natural for me. I would never say, have you a room? I'd always say, do you have a room? But we do. It's just like, it's odd how we do that.
Yeah, I would. I mean, we can't obviously go back and ask. But I am curious why that changed, you know, why that do support really happened.
Yeah, no, I'm just at the point where language is just capricious. It just, I think a lot of times you just can't figure, it just happens. People play with it, they do it, and it kicks in.
Because it's true,
it
ends up being clunkier. I mean, if we were going to be Noah Webster, who wanted to simplify things, get rid of the use and this and that, then why are we also chucking in extra, extraneous words?
No.
And why does it sound so wrong to me to say, have you a room? Why does it make me want to slap you?
It sounds awful to me. I agree with you, Kat.
It's just like,
I'll
be quiet. Get your room by yourself.
Well, moving along, do you remember, Fletcher, a couple of weeks ago we were talking about calcs?
Calcs, yeah. So either we're going to be talking now about limestone, which I learned is one one kind of calc or comes from, or we're going to be talking about words that came directly from another language. Is that right?
Well said. Well said, Fletcher.
So not
yes.
translations, but words that came like exactly.
No, you got it backwards.
Duh.
Calcs are actually word for word translations from one to another.
Okay.
Basically, a loan word is when you take like cafe. Comes from the French.
We just took the word. A loan word. We don't have to give it back, though, do we?
No, we get to keep it.
No.
However, we were going to actually talk more about limestone, Fletcher, and geology. We're switching.
Speaking of cafe, though, it always fascinates me here that cafeterias are like coffee shops. And in my head, I have the American thing where cafeterias, you have your tray, you go up, you get your thing, and, you know, you pay for your chicken a la king and your, you know, apple pie.
All right.
Yeah. Oh,
and it sort of freaks me out that cafeteria, when I see cafeteria here, it's just a coffee place, which, of course.
In Greek, it's the same thing. It's weird. Yeah. I have the same problem with Greek, modern Greek, it's the same thing. But it makes sense that it is. But
of course, but it bothers me.
I know. I agree with you, Kat. Okay, but anyway, a calc, Fletcher, is what we were talking about, is translating the components of a phrase or word literally into another language. I mean, do you happen to know the French word for skyscraper by any chance?
Ciel scraper.
You're actually sort of close.
Close!
It's grand ciel, and it's a direct translation into French from English, which is scrape the sky.
Okay.
It's exactly what it is.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to do calcs, not in French, but in English. Kath, you want to go to... actually, there's one, though, it's interesting, too, because there can be problems with calcs. You want to do the Spanish one, which I thought was really interesting. There's a Spanish phrase that we have in this, in a couple of our notes, and it's, forgive my pronunciation, está lloviendo a cántaros. Which apparently literally means it's raining pitchers. Now, if you're taking that literally as a calc into English, if I said to you, Fletcher, it's raining pitchers, you might kind of get the idea, or you might think of baseball pitchers. I don't know. But as Kath, is that used or not?
I have not heard this. I mean, the problem is, to be honest with you, I'm not good at catching. I mean, I live in Granada, where it's like they speak Andalusian Spanish. So when they talk, it's like really fast and it's very slurred. That said, I mean, I actually think that it's kind of understandable, though. I mean, it's cats and dogs to me is more confusing. This one to me is not that confusing, is all I'm saying. Is it to you, really?
Yeah, no.
Well, the purpose of quick communication, though, is like saying it's raining pitchers to me isn't instantly. I mean, you're doing split fraction of a second understandings of things. And it's raining pitchers. If someone says it's raining pitchers, I'm thinking this person's a foreigner. They're using something really wrong. That's what I'm saying.
I would assume that they were from a different region of the country. Since nobody says that. But also, maybe not. You know what? Maybe not even that. I might assume it was just a kind of older, timier phrase.
Could be that, too.
Something colloquial. And I would think, oh, raining pitchers. That's cute.
That's cute.
That's what I would think.
Okay, so anyway, that's true. And a lot of times, though, this was really interesting to me because I never really thought about it. But sometimes we take... that like things like raining pitchers and literally take it into the language, including different structures of words. And I never really thought about it because I'm so used to it. But they're called syntactic calcs, where we literally take how they use the word in a sentence. And fine by me is a syntactic calc from Yiddish. But when you think about it, it's sort of true because we would never say by me with most other things. It's more natural to say with me.
Yeah.
You know?
That's interesting. You're absolutely right. And I never really thought of that. But I say fine by me all the time.
I do too.
Yeah.
And apparently we're taken from Yiddish. I can't pronounce the Yiddish, but bei mir, literally by me. And where they use it all the time. But I would never by me otherwise.
Yeah, not in any other context. I mean, okay by me, you know, there might be another word other than fine, but...
Yeah, but in that that's just that phrase in effect.
Yeah.
The by me part is completely,
Yeah, wow.
It's weird. It's taken that... And the other one, Kath, you want to go through this one? This was interesting, too.
Oh, the in order to was an odd one.
Yeah. Isn't that weird?
In order to. I never thought of in order to. I'm going to do that in order to... whatever. And that comes from the, it's a calque from the French, which I will not even attempt. Ross, you can do it since I don't speak French. But yeah, you never express purpose like that in English, except for in order to.
Huh.
You would just usually say to, actually.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you? You would just say to.
So I can. I'm going to do this so I can do that. Yeah.
And then by heart was another calque. That comes from the French, parcours.
Oh,
but
really?
You just don't, when you think about it, you wouldn't say that either. I'm going to learn it by heart.
And it goes without saying.
Ooh, Kathy, clever.
Goes without
saying. I like
saying.
It. Goes without saying.
That's a
calque? Yeah.
I would have just assumed that's, you know, just an idiomatic phrase rather than a direct translation from something.
No, it's a calque. Yeah. Ça va sans dire.
Wow.
Well, the next one, this is always one of my favorite calques, as you know, Ross.
I do, Kathy.
Should I do it?
Yes.
Superman. Do you know that one,
that's
Fletcher?
Isn't that from Nietzsche?
Yes. Uberman. Yeah. I always loved that.
This one really bothered me because I knew Nietzsche with, Thus Spoke Zarathustra, and I knew that he had Superman. And then, as a kid, I really liked George Bernard Shaw, and I read his book, his play, Man and Superman.
Man and Superman. Mm-hmm. One of my favorites,
so
too.
So we were doing research on calques with Kath. I said, do you know Superman comes from the German Übermensch? And Kath said, yeah. Didn't you know that?
And I
thought,
duh.
Oh, my God. I read both of those things, and I didn't know it. I didn't think, I did not, which is interesting. That just shows how you don't, I mean, you, sometimes the mind, even a quick mind like mine, can't connect to the obvious things. And I'm begging for people to go, I agree, it's quick. It's not quick, it's stupid. I didn't get it at all. And apparently George Bernard Shaw read or knew of Nietzsche's his Superman idea. And it was Englished initially, apparently, as Overman in the 1890s and Beyond Man. And then Shaw took a much better Superman and made it Superman.
Okay.
Yeah, well, Overman would be the literal word-for-word translation. Actually, Overman would be the calque. In a funny way, Superman's like a quasi-calque, isn't it? Because it's not.
You're right. That's a good one.
Yeah, because Uber is not super. Uber is over.
But super. Yeah. But super means over, right?
It does. It means over in Latin. Yeah. That's where we go back to that.
So never mind, it's calque. It's not a quasi-calque.
Well, it's a modified limited quasi-calque.
Oh, Ross, to the bag end. That fascinated me.
Oh, yeah, this was really interesting. There's sort of like a reverse play on calques. Okay, do you know the French word, which is now obviously English, cul-de-sac? You know that. That's a loan word into English, right?
Cul-de-sac, yeah, the little area where the end of the street where the houses, you know, there's a little half circle of houses sitting there.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know this at all. Do you know the Hobbit by J.R.R. Tolkien, don't you?
Sure.
Where does Frodo live?
Frodo's not in the Hobbit.
No, Bilbo.
Oh, I'm sorry. Bilbo, you're right. Bilbo, sorry.
Okay,
Bilbo.
Okay.
Bilbo. Well, Frodo lives there in the next book, so whatever. Yeah.
The Shire, right?
Yeah,
the name of the house.
The specific place he lives at.
Isn't it like Bag End or something?
Yes. And that was Tolkien doing a reverse play on cul-de-sac. He took cul-de-sac, which is for the French, as a loan word, and made it into a calque in his book.
Isn't that cool?
Bag, right.
Because cul is end, and then sac, bottom or end, and then sac is obviously a bag.
Yeah.
Isn't that cool?
Yes. That's really funny. I never, ever would have connected that.
And then, Kathy, you want to do...
Oh, this one. Rhinestone, I like. The clue is right there where it came from. Rhinestone.
Is it?
Rhinestone.
Yes.
Oh, like a stone found on the banks of the Rhine.
Hey, good thinking, Fletch. And it was a Rhine pebble.
Oh,
rhinestone.
Cute.
It was so called because they used to make these colorless stones out of paste or glass. Near Strasbourg on the River Rhine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's an interesting one. The next one is really interesting, too, because it's a slightly modified, one of Kathy's more modified, shall we call it, calques. Okay, scapegoat. Do you have any idea where it came from, Fletcher?
Oh, boy. I think we talked about scapegoat once.
That's why we asked you.
But I think, boy, I sure don't remember. Scapegoat. No, I don't know. I don't remember.
Okay, this is really weird because it comes from the Bible. It comes from Hebrew, I can't pronounce it, Ezozel, which is the goat that departs. Then it came in as a calc into English as
Escape
the escape goat.
Uh-huh.
But the E was dropped because in those days you didn't have to say escape, you could say scape. And then it came into English as scapegoat. Which is funny because when I read it, I don't think of goat escaping. I just read it as a scapegoat, just
yeah.
as a person who's a scapegoat. I don't hear escape in there.
What I also find interesting is that we see all the time on lists of, you know, incorrect spellings or usages, people calling it an escape goat, and that's wrong, but actually they're kind of right.
They are kind of right.
If they lived, you know, back in the 1500s or something, you know?
Funny. So how does an escaped goat become what we think of as a scapegoat? Like, can you blame it on the goat that escaped because nobody can?
Oh, I see what you're saying. How did it really? Well, the Bible, the goat was sent into the wilderness, and like, because the priest put all the sins on the goat.
Ah, okay.
So the goat went had the sins and left. So I guess a scapegoat is someone who's, you know, blamed for being, you know, unjustly or whatever. But I guess maybe the goat was. I guess even then they thought, well, gee, poor goat, maybe.
You know? Well, the thing that's weird, though, is they had two goats, right? So one was sent out in the wilderness and the other one was sacrificed. So the scapegoat is out in the wilderness. So then the other goat, which is not taking all the sins, is killed.
Yes.
I don't know about you, but doesn't that seem kind of...
I never thought of that. You're completely correct. That's like, you know, I'd rather be the scapegoat than the dead goat, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, okay, maybe you've got all the sins, but you're in the wilderness, you're munching on your bush here and your grass there.
Yeah,
the
you're
other
right.
one's dead.
And now we get all the letters from the theologians out there that will tell us.
Let's just do a few more cows quickly. Moment of truth. Fletcher, do you know where this comes from? And we have a clue here because we have someone we're speaking to who is in Spain.
Oh. That seems like a pretty big clue.
Yes.
Is it from Spanish?
Wow. Good guess.
Yes. But what do you think? El momento de la verdad.
Oh, that's nice. Yes, that's good. And you said that really with a lot of verve there. I like it.
Well, there would be verve in this momento de la verdad.
Does it refer to something specific?
Yeah.
It's something that I'm not really wild about anymore. But do they still do it in Spain, Kath, all the time or not?
Yes, they do.
Are you going to tell me
something? I don't like that.
They do it here. There is still a bowl.
Yeah, I was going to say.
There's still an arena here.
Well,
for
that's where I was headed. I was going to ask, is this about bullfighting?
Yes.
Is this
correct.
So is this the part where they stab the bull between the eyes?
Yes.
It's when the matador makes the kill. Yeah.
Maybe on the neck. Maybe it's on the neck. Maybe it's not between the eyes. See how much I know about bullfighting? I don't want to know anymore.
Yeah, I wouldn't know either.
So why truth? Why truth? Do you know?
Catherine,
well,
can
because
you know
the
that?
Bull's dead. No, I don't. I'm assuming it's because you're killing the bull. So it's the moment of truth.
And it just sounds better than
the matador has won, the bull is dead.
Yeah, moment of bull murder.
Of killing.
It doesn't...
I can tell you, though, that it first appeared in English in Hemingway.
That
Hemingway's
was really
the one
weird
who...
to find out. I didn't know that. Hemingway was the first.
Yeah.
This was a really weird one. Deep state. This was really weird.
That's from another language.
Yep.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you a clue. It comes from this phrase, probably mispronounced, Derin Devlet. Oh, I just realized Devlet is Dowlet in Arabic, so I do sort of know. I would have known that part. Anyway.
Hmm.
I'm not sure you know the language. I wouldn't have known it when I heard it.
No, tell me.
Turkish.
Turkish. So does it refer to whatever nebulous thing it refers to here in the U.S.?
Yep.
Okay.
There was a Turkish historian. Yeah, Ryan Gagaris or something. Turkish historian who basically defined it as the shadow or parallel system of government. Same thing as here.
Hmm.
It was the last day of the Ottomans.
Yep.
They used clandestine forces, like a secret police and thugs and stuff, to try to keep things a little more contained.
Yeah.
I would have thought Deep State was A, not a calc, and if it were, I would not have thought of Turkey, and B, I would have thought it was much more recent.
Mm-hmm.
I would have thought so too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But I really thought it was a construct of the last decades, you know?
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay, here's one that's really interesting. This is a sort of a double calc, nostalgia.
Nostalgia? I would have just assumed that this was a loan word, honestly.
That's partly true. I mean, it is a loan word.
Okay.
This is a weirdie, because this one basically, there was a German scholar, or no, I guess a Swiss scholar, Johannes Hofer, who had, there was a word in German, Catholic, can you pronounce this? I can't. Heimweh, which is homesickness. Okay. And then they changed this into the Greek, agos, which is pain, and nostos, which is homecoming. So it's like pain at homecoming, to want to return home.
Oh, boy.
From there, it got into the French and the army manuals, where they said soldiers don't want to be in the front, they want to go home. Then from there...
I blame them.
I know. Then from there, it became basically, in the American Civil War, it became basically, again, we have these soldiers were reported with nostalgia, which meant they're like either trying depressingly homesick. Then from there, it came into the French literature, where it became a little bit different. It became sort of wanting something distant and different. Then meanwhile, it went back into German, and the Germans now took nostalgia to mean not homesickness, but the new word nostalgia.
Holy
Isn't that really
cow.
Cool?
Wow. What a journey.
I know. And now we don't say nostalgia for being homesick. We say homesick.
Right.
Can I end with earworm, just because that's like a lighthearted one and I didn't know that was a calc?
Yeah, okay, good. Do
earworm.
An earworm.
Earworm.
So like a song that you can't get out of your head?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, an earworm. Wow. No, I didn't know this was a calc. Is this as recent a term as I would have expected, or are you going to tell me it goes back farther?
No, it's older than I would have expected, actually. It's not super old, but it's not quite as old as, it's not quite as new. It's from the German Ohrwurm, and it was 100 years ago, over 100 years ago,
really?
And it means exactly what it is. I mean, a song stuck in your head.
Oh my gosh!
And it just caught on. So they say scientists also called it stuck tune syndrome and musical imagery repetition, but for some reason, earworm caught on.
Yeah, I wonder why. When did earworm explode in use here? Do you know? I mean, it seems like over the last, let's say, 20 years or so.
You got it, Fletcher. Exactly. Well, not 20. It's a little bit older than that. But the first known English usage is in Desmond Bagley's 1978 novel, Fly Away.
Mm-hmm.
And he points out that it's from the German. Isn't that? I thought, I would have thought, the whole thing is interesting.
I thought an earworm was definitely English. I thought it was an American word.
Yeah.
I would never have cast it as.
How funny. And definitely not one that's been percolating for 100 years.
Nope.
Wow.
But let's hope our show will become an earworm show for everyone. Thinking about it over and over.
I don't know. I don't. There's something that doesn't quite do me, Ross.
You're Saying It Wrong is part of the NPR network and is produced in the studios of KMUW in Wichita, Kansas by me, Fletcher Powell. Kathy Petras records from her home in Armilla, Spain. Ross Petras from his home in Toronto, Ontario in Canada. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. Our digital team is Beth Golay and Carly Cooper. Carly Cooper is also our video editor. You can subscribe to our channel on YouTube. You can find all of our past episodes by subscribing to the You're Saying It Wrong podcast, wherever you get your podcasts, or by visiting us at kmuw.org. If you have a question for Kathy and Ross, if you'd like to suggest a topic, or you just want to reach out, you can email me at powell@kmuw.org. or email them at kandrpetras@gmail.com. You can also record a voice memo of yourself asking your question. You might get your voice heard on air. Or you can download the KMUW app and press the Talk to Us button. You can find Kathy and Ross's books pretty much anywhere you get books, and a handful of them are also available on audiobook, read by the authors themselves. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week.
rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.